I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. BuzzFeed published a dossier earlier this week about unsubstantiated claims that Russian officials had compromising information on Donald Trump they were prepared to use as blackmail. This was information included in last week's intelligence briefings for President-elect Trump and President Obama that was leaked. It reportedly was information gathered by a former British spy opposition research for first Republicans running against Trump and then for Democrats. Donald Trump called the allegations fake news and called out BuzzFeed. Other news organizations did not publish the dossier because they could not verify the anonymous charges. We asked Adam Ronsley to join us. He's national security reporter who co-authors the Sit Rep column for Foreign Policy with Paul McCleary. He also writes for Wired and the Daily Beast. And Adam Ronsley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
I was thinking about that word dossier. I mean, it's such an old-fashioned word. Among intelligence officials, does that have a specific or special meaning?
No. What's important to realize about the dossier that was circulated and published by BuzzFeed is that people are calling it a private intelligence firm and a private intelligence document. And while that's certainly true, that has a lot of different meanings. Private intelligence companies work for the United States government all the time. They take the form of Booz Allen Hamilton, you know, SAIC, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed. And these are people who do work, you know, side by side with members of the intelligence community in the defense world. They have security clearances. To all appearances from the outside, there's not a lot of difference between them and somebody who works for the government. What this dossier was and what this company was a different kind of private security. The euphemism that's often associated with it is due diligence. And what it is, you know, somebody like Mr. Steele, who's identified.
That's the man identified.
Identified by the Wall Street Journal as the author of this, you know, opened his firm. And what a lot of these firms do is they employ a lot of former intelligence people. And let's say you are a large bank. You know, I'm Adam Corp and I want to invest in Krasnovia, but Krasnovia doesn't have a really strong rule of law and there's potential for high returns on my investment, but I want to know who I'm getting in the business with and it's not entirely clear. What I'll do is I'll hire someone who has connections in that country, who has experience in collecting human intelligence, who can, you know, sort of sniff around and make friends and talk to people, and he can tell me if there's anything, you know, I should be aware of. And that's sort of, even though it's alleged that Mr. Steele is a former officer in Her Majesty's Secret Service, this was not a formal intelligence document. This is not, it's been circulating through the press for weeks, for months actually.
Since the summer.
And this is not, you know, it is, while the U.S. government may have classified it, it is not classified material. It is a private intelligence firm's, you know, own collection of rumor and gossip.
And he was hired, or his firm was hired, to do what they call opposition research. Let me just finish there. And one of the words that I've heard used to describe it was that this means it was disinformation. The idea that because it was opposition research, it was fake, wrong. Can we say that?
What you can say is the document contains a number of claims. Some of them appear very, very dubious on the face. One of them is that one of Mr. Trump's associates, Michael Cohen, met with Russian officials in the Czech Republic. There is no evidence of that. Mr. Cohen has strongly disputed that. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, others have sort of given him an alibi on that. There is a lot more heat than light in that document. Whether or not it amounts to fake news and, whether or not it is whole cloth fake has yet to be proven, mostly because a lot of this stuff in that document, you know, it can't be proven one way or the other. But to the extent we've been able to prove or disprove things, as, you know, BuzzFeed initially wrote in when it released the document, is that, you know, there's a lot in there that does not check out. There's, you know, misspellings of Russian names that sort of raise questions. There's a little bit of confusion about a couple of places in there. What intelligence people will say is that, well, listen, intelligence is a process, right? Is that you go from collecting it to analyzing and verifying it, and then you disseminate it. And what we're looking at here is something very, very early in the process. This is raw intelligence. So it may be a mixture of rumor. It may be a mixture of noise and garbage. But there may be a little bit of nugget of truth in there that we can, you know, later verify. And, you know, that may well be true. But, you know, from the purpose of, you know, being a citizen observing this and from the purpose of being a reporter – right now, there's a lot more heat than light, and there's a lot more disproven claims than proven ones in it. And so I think it has to be treated, at least for the moment, very, very skeptically.
Well, let me quote something that James Clapper said, director of National Intelligence. And he said that the intelligence agencies have not made any judgment about the information in this document and whether it's reliable or not. And I'm assuming – I'm not part of the intelligence community, and I've never been briefed on intelligence, but I'm assuming – that a lot of information is shared that is not necessarily been vetted. It's information that perhaps you should know that's been swirling around the internet, but well, that doesn't make it true.
That's, I mean, but that's the question that goes to the heart of this issue, is because from the outside, one possible interpretation of this is that, you know, CNN broke this story in its current formation. Mother Jones ran a version of this story before the election, but you know where we are right now dates to the publication of that CNN story with Jake Tapper and Carl Bernstein, and you know the news hook for their story, even though that dossier had been circulating for months, was that, well, this is serious because we've learned that the intelligence community has briefed this to Trump and President Obama and included it. And, you know, to read some of the reporting about the intelligence community's point of view is they're saying another version of, you know, the opposite version of that as well. The reason why we included this is because it's been going around and, you know, the press has been circulating it. And so we include it in there. The question,
kind of a circular argument. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. The question is, and I think this gets to the heart of the question, is, you know, ideally a professional intelligence organization should not make a routine habit of, you know, circulating raw intelligence. The question that gets to the heart of this is, why did you, you know, is its inclusion in a very high level document a reflection of the intelligence community's belief that there may or may not be something to this? And there's a little bit of an indication that, you know, the FBI may have seen something in this from Julian Borges reporting in The Guardian. He reported that, you know, as part of this sort of wider investigation, that at some point the FBI applied for a FISA warrant, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a special court set up. So if you want to receive a warrant to spy on an American because you believe they're involved in something related to national security, you apply to this. And Julian Borger reported that at some point the FBI applied for a warrant to the FISA court for some of Mr. Trump's associates based on very unspecified, and I should hasten to add, unproven beliefs about their dealings with Russian individuals. And as is a pattern with this story, you know, we know that they were turned down initially by the FISA court. But there's a big question mark over whether or not their second bite at the apple ended up being more successful. Mm. But again, as with a lot of this story, there's more question marks than there are answers.
Absolutely. Being turned down by the FISA court, does that happen every day?
If you ask surveillance critics, the FISA court, I forget what the exact percentage is, but the FISA court does have a relatively high percentage of approvals for warrants. If you ask surveillance critics, they will tell you that is because that the FISA court is, you know, too sympathetic to the government and is, you know, something akin to a rubber stamp. If you ask people on the intelligence side, they will tell you the opposite. They will say, well, the reason why they approve so many warrants is because you know, it's a very rigorous process to get a warrant from the FISA court, and we only apply when we really, really know. Again, you know, It, without access to, you know, reviewing the applications and the circumstances, it's very hard to say one way or the other.
when it comes to journalism, there are ways to that you're supposed to vet information. Is that also true for the intelligence community? Do they go through a similar process of checking sources and getting second opinions, things like that?
Absolutely, yes. And you saw a little bit of that with the estimate released by the intelligence community on a different but somewhat related story for the accusations of Russian hacking and interference in the election. Agencies don't always agree. When it comes to a big national level question, what you'll get is a what's called a national intelligence estimate, where the intelligence community will round up all its various members and say, OK, on this big issue, what does, you know, the Department of Energy's intelligence shop say? What does the FBI say? And, you know, they're supposed to come together, you know, obviously at the individual level, you know, this is the job of analysis. Intelligence is, you know, you have collectors who are spies, who are, you know, people who work in signals intelligence, who collect information. And then it goes through an analysis process where you, you know, just like journalism, sure. You know, you sort of verify and check this without, you know, what is this source's reliability? Has this person lied to us in the past? Is there any other sort of confirming process? And then, you know, if it's a big enough national level question, you know, that gets through another process in the national intelligence estimate, and, you know, you start bouncing it off and log rolling between the different agencies. And that's what you saw on the cyber question.
You mentioned NIE, and I remember that from the Iraq war. And one of the criticisms of the intelligence community is that they were wrong about weapons of mass destruction, therefore they could be wrong about that. Does that hold water from your perspective?
No, because the point is that you should be skeptical of what governments tell you. That's a good starting point for any citizen. That's a good starting point for any reporter. But you cannot say because an intelligence community was wrong on one particular issue that in perpetuity they will always be wrong on another issue. There were very specific identifiable reasons why they were wrong on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, the interesting issue there was that, you know, in that case, it wasn't as though the entire intelligence community was in unison saying, yes, we all believe to the hilt that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. You know, in the NIE, it got a little bit buried in the public process. But, you know,
there was
a
difference of opinion.
Yeah, there was a strong difference of opinion with State Department not concurring on certain points and Department of Energy taking some exception to some points. But it does have that sort of veneer of Iraq, if only because, you know, there's this supposed and very much unproven and very dubious allegation of a meeting between Michael Cohen and a Russian government official in Prague in the Czech Republic, which has this sort of, you know, people are referring to it as the dodgy dossier, which is sort of another echo of the Iraq war intelligence. But the other echo is that, you know, if you remember going back, the allegations of Iraq's relationship with al-Qaeda.
Meeting in Prague.
Yes, about a meeting between Mohammed Atta and Iraqi officials in Prague.
I got to jump in here, only because we're up on a break here. I should say that Michael Cohen said he's never been to Prague.
Exactly. No. There's no evidence he has. So.
Adam Ronsley, stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with Adam Ronsley about the dossier that's gotten so much attention this week. And, of course, what it says about Donald Trump's relationship with the intelligence community. And he's a national security reporter, co-authors the SIP Rep column for Foreign Policy with Paul McCleary. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us with WHYY. Radio Times. Now, yesterday, Donald Trump said he does think that Russia was behind the hacking of the Democratic National Convention committee, I should say. But how do you see the relationship between Donald Trump and the intelligence community? I mean, he's been obviously much more public about his criticisms. I wonder, even with this leaked doc, whether that says something about the intelligence community.
Well, the only way to describe the relationship between the two at this point is just purely poisonous. This is not great for morale in the intelligence community. When you have a president, dropping the Nazi word in a tweet saying, why is this document out? This is reminiscent of Nazi tactics. That does not bode well for the morale of the intelligence community. He's, from what we know of President-elect Trump, he's a very sensitive man, does not take kindly and deal with criticism or adverse information very well. Going in, he did not seem overly impressed or, taken with the value of intelligence, saying, I'm a smart guy, I know a lot, I know more than generals. And that's just – it's not just bad for the intelligence community. It's bad for him, and it's bad for his presidency, because every president at some point in their career is going to have a national security crisis, especially recently. Presidents are going to have to rely on intelligence in order to make a case to support their policy. President-elect Trump is not a big fan of Iran. President-elect Trump is not a big fan of the Iran deal. If whatever you think of the merits of the deal, if he wants to call out what he believes to be an example of Iranian cheating on the deal, well, he's going to have to rely on the intelligence community that he just publicly trashed. There's going to come a point where something, he's going to get a 3 a.m. phone call and he's going to have to rely on people he distrusts and who are very wary of him. And that does not really help the policymaking process.
How powerful would you say the intelligence community, and that, of course, includes many agencies under the heading of the intelligence community, but just how powerful do you think they are?
Less powerful than the public imagination. I mean, obviously, they have the ability to, tell the press very juicy things about how good or bad the president's policies is going based on their, collection streams. But the intelligence community, even though it shares a good chunk of real estate with the Defense Department, is not the Defense Department. It is not the military where, if you are a congressman on one of the intelligence committees, you can't tell your congressman that, you built a covert operation in your district. The public does not have the sort of same respect and faith in the institution of the intelligence community and the way that they do the military or maybe something else. They can certainly, damage the president a little bit. But I think, long term, this is not I would be hard pressed to come up with examples where intelligence community has picked a fight with a president over the long term and won.
Let me get some callers in before we have to say goodbye. We've got Rick from, looks like, Hocassin, Delaware. And Rick, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Go ahead, Rick.
Happy New Year, Marty.
Thanks.
And thank you. Wonderful program. Only thing is I lived in three countries. I lived abroad 20 years. One of them we overthrew it twice, the government. Once, Guatemala, 53. And only 10 years ago, we didn't allow López Obrador to win in Mexico. He's going to come back, by the way, in 2 years. And here we are wringing our hands because the Russians have intervened. It's just sad. The world is laughing at us because we've done this time and time again all over the world, and now it comes back to hit us. And it's very personal for the Russians to me because Hillary said that the parliamentary elections about 5 years ago as Secretary of State were corrupted, and she also criticized Assad, Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks, and these guys paid her back, and it was personal. But I do find it fascinating to see our country writhing a little bit and wringing our hands over this when we've done it to everybody else.
Well, Rick, I appreciate the call, and has this come back to bite us?
I don't know that you can draw. I mean, obviously, the United States is a prolific changer of governments that it did not like in the 20th century and in the 21st century as well, most particularly in Iraq. I don't think you can – it's not that, Vladimir Putin was paying us back for changing governments before. I think there is certainly an element of payback. If you read the intelligence estimate that the DNI released on the hacking allegations, it certainly seems to come to the conclusion that this began as a grudge against Secretary Clinton, And that, you know, he did not go into, or at least from the intelligence community's point of view, that Russia did not go into this expecting Trump to win. They went into it more to needle the United States and Secretary Clinton in particular. So, you know, I would say there's a strong element of payback. I would not necessarily say that that is tied to, you know, sort of Cold War gripes about changing governments. It's more about, you know, current day geopolitics.
Final question to you. And you describe this conflicted, rocky, perhaps hostile relationship between Donald Trump and the intelligence community. Do you expect some kind of detente or some kind of warming of that relationship?
If anything, over the past year, I've learned is to not trust predictions because they have a habit. I could not have predicted that we'd be in the situation where we are right now. But I don't see how this de-escalates anytime soon. It largely hinges on President-elect Trump's choices in policy and people. But I don't see him as a guy that lets go of grudges easily. And I think we're going to be going through this for quite a while.
Well, stay tuned. Adam Rawlinsey, thank you for coming in on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. National security reporter, co-authors the Sit Rep column for Foreign Policy. He also writes for Wired and The Daily Beast. Well, as we all know, Tuesday night's leak of unverified information regarding Donald Trump's ties to Russia is the latest in a long season of political leaks. Many journalistic outlets, they did denounce BuzzFeed's decision to release the unsubstantiated claims regarding Russia's alleged influence over the president, over the president-elect, and Trump's team was quick to do the same. Our guest, Eric Wemple, is media reporter for The Washington Post. He has some thoughts about this, and he joins us from the studios of The Washington Post. And Eric Wemple, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. You are, have been critical, as many have, of BuzzFeed's decision to publish parts of, or actually the whole dossier. On what grounds?
Just the basic sort of blocking and tackling here. I mean, there are a bunch of very exotic claims, some of one or two of which have been pretty well knocked down by now. And there is this dossier, as we talked about, and it's been circulated. It originated in political opposition research, which is sort of the sleaziest or one of the sleaziest areas of inquiry that you can get, simply because it's used for political purposes. So there's always an extra spin on it to begin with. So it evolved from there, moved up into the ranks of intelligence, something that intelligence people were discussing. And I do think it was a significant and a legitimate news story that this was being discussed in intelligence briefings, or at least on intelligence documents, with President Obama and President-elect Trump. However, it's one thing to state that this document has escalated to those levels, and it's quite another just to drop the entire thing on the web and pretty much without redaction. I think that's a different matter.
Well, and one of the explanations was that the editor of BuzzFeed wanted to let the American public make up their minds about Donald Trump, to know what people in the highest levels of government know. So what is wrong with that?
Well, I think that's preposterous. I think that editors often use that term, we'll let Americans decide for themselves, when you're talking about an important policy debates where all the facts are out in the open, where people's positions are very well known, where there have been hearings and so on and so forth. That is a perfect, you know, thing to say. We'll let the people decide for themselves. We've laid all the facts out. Here, people can't decide for themselves. It's impossible. They would need their own intelligence agencies to reach these sort of conclusions. So this is the sort of mission and function that a news organization has, which is to investigate them yourselves and to see if you can corroborate them, to see if you can verify them. And if not, just to basically let them gather dust. I mean, that is a long journalistic tradition of doing exactly that. And that is really the most fundamental role of journalists. To thrust them right out there, I think, is wrong. BuzzFeed said that it would continue to report on them and seek to verify them. And my question is, well, if you're going to continue to report on them, why publish them now? So that's my fundamental critique. There is another side to the story, but
well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. I mean,
yeah,
one of
I'm
the,
sure we'll get to that.
One of the things that BuzzFeed said was, and they included in their message to their readers was, these are unverified allegations. The report
Correct.
Includes errors. I mean, they did say to their readers, take this with a grain of salt. Does that get them off the hook?
I don't believe it ever does. I mean, only if you can state for sure. I mean, they're flying blind. They can't say what is real and what is not real. I think there is merit in, say, when someone makes, say, a public figure uses false accusations and other falsehoods, as Donald Trump routinely does, I think there's merit in laying those out and saying why they're false. But this is a different matter. This is a matter where we don't really know. Well, now we know. We don't really know who came up with these, how they came up with them. And they're out of the blue pretty much. I don't think it helps to issue those qualifiers in this particular instance. I feel that is just further confusion and sort of misery to this entire process. I think it's a weak crutch for BuzzFeed to lean on.
Well, and it does put us, the rest of the journalist community, into this weird position, because here we are, Eric, having this conversation about the thing that was published by one outlet, BuzzFeed. Other outlets decided not to do it, and yet it's become the topic or a big topic of conversation. Do you feel like you're in an awkward position yourself?
Yeah, because it's kind of becoming part of the the cultural conversation too. You know, Samantha Bee, I think last night addressed some specifics. So, you know, the cat's sort of out of the bag at this point. And you know, even if you take this sort of position, I suppose you could call it ascetic position or, you know, whatever, a position of great restraint to say, I'm not going to discuss these.
Right.
Well, these things have become part of the cultural conversation. You can't ignore them for very long. So they sort of overwhelm us. And that's a point that Jack Schaefer made in Politico yesterday. But I do think that there is still a significant traditional role of media organizations to play, which is to say, we're not going to put this out there until we know it's true. I think that is just such a fundamental blocking and tackling part of journalism. And that's where I stand on it. I do understand the other side, though.
Well, do you think BuzzFeed was acting more like WikiLeaks?
That's a really good question. And that's where the other argument comes in. And it's been made pretty forcefully by, as I say, Jack Schaefer and also Matthew Ingram, I believe, of Fortune, which is that, hey, look, this has become essentially a FOIA document, a government document, one that you would try to secure through a Freedom of Information Act request, right? So if it's being discussed at the upper levels of government, why wouldn't you go ahead and publish it? And I think that's a pretty legitimate argument. That's not a wild person's argument. That's not a crazy argument, because it has bubbled up to that level. And so I think that there's something there. However, you know, even at those levels, it's been reported by CNN and others that the FBI itself is seeking to confirm these things, which means that it's not a sort of sanctioned, authorized piece of U.S. intelligence. It's something that came in from the blue mist and is now being talked about. But these things haven't been corroborated even by our own intelligence services. So usually something you get from FOIA about intelligence or whatever, you might find the considered opinion and something that has sort of the imprimatur of the government. This is not that case. So I do think it's an anomaly, and it's an interesting one. And there's a reason why you're talking about it,
sure.
I'm talking about
sure.
it. And it's
a lot
all
of people
over,
are talking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But do you think that
just because it's fascinating?
It is fascinating, and even beyond what it alleges, just the fascination of that we're awash with all this information and we're trying to all make sense of it. But do you think what BuzzFeed did? Do you think that has hurt the media in general, or is it too soon to tell?
I think it has, and I think that, you know, one of the interesting twists about the Donald Trump era is that I think that through his sort of intimidation tactics, through his constant focus on the media, I think that he's used media criticism as basically a substitute for policy. I mean, I don't think he has much to say on the on the country's problems, so that he has resorted to even using more media criticism than his predecessors have. And I think that a result is that we see the media being attacked and scrutinized even more than ever. And I do think that he yesterday and his press secretary, incoming press secretary Sean Spicer, sought to bundle BuzzFeed in with CNN, even though CNN limited themselves to talking about government process story, which is that this particular dossier had circulated at the highest levels of government. And so in doing that, they're looking to slime everyone with what I view as a misstep by one organization. And so I think that as time goes on, you know, the idea of every media organization being absolutely 100% bulletproof on every decision is going to become more and more important, because Donald Trump will never, ever let anybody forget about it. And as we know, he has millions and millions of followers on Twitter and every means available to hammer us. And the one thing you don't want to let him do is have a point.
Well, that's a very good point, Eric. Let's take a very short break. And I do want to play a clip from that press conference from yesterday. Eric Wemple reports on and writes about the media for The Washington Post. And we are talking about the dossier that's gotten so much attention. And we do want to talk more about what it's the challenges, I guess, of covering, of writing about Donald Trump, and some of the ethical issues that journalists are facing these days. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play a testy moment from yesterday's press conference. Jim Acosta from CNN trying to ask Donald Trump a question.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question? No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
So, Eric Wemple, what do you hear in that exchange back and forth?
I hear a bully of a president-elect not wanting to face the consequences of the sort of slime that he had already heaped on CNN. I hear a president that did not want to be held accountable, that wanted to shift the topic of this conversation somewhere else. He wanted to be able to slam CNN and put them in the same bundle as BuzzFeed and not be held accountable for having done so. And I also hear other reporters, you know, basically helping him, assisting him in that by failing to repeat the CNN reporter's question. I do think that when I'm not much of an advocate for collective action among news organizations. I think they always should be competing against each other and trying to bust each other out. But in a situation like that where the president-elect refuses to stand up and answer for a very legitimate inquiry, I think that there is cause for other reporters in the Corps, in the White House press corps, to say, you know what? I'm going to put aside my own question for a second and insist that you answer this question, which I believe is the question that CNN wanted answered. I think that there's justification for that. Do you?
Let me ask you a couple of questions here. I can hide behind my questions, I guess. But just for our listeners to understand, so CNN did not do what BuzzFeed did, and that's the point you're trying to make, right?
Right, right. I thought we'd cover this, but basically BuzzFeed put the entire – what happened on Tuesday night was that CNN interrupted its regular program to drop this big news bomb, which is that this dossier had been – a summary of this dossier had been appended to intelligence briefing documents, and that President Obama and Donald Trump – it had been addressed to them, either in a briefing or via document, that this dossier that was put together by a British intelligence official, originally as opposition research, had bumped up to the highest level of government, and it contained allegations that the Russians were seeking to get or had compromising material on Donald Trump. So CNN did not give the details of that document because it couldn't confirm them. Moments later, BuzzFeed published the entire thing with all the details. And so there's a difference there.
Right.
CNN was reporting on sort of like actions in the government, and BuzzFeed just dropped this entire document on the internet. And so so Trump was trying to lump them together when, in fact, they had done very different things. And he did not want to answer to CNN.
But does it also, and only because I think you know more about the media than I do, but does it also reflect just the level of competition that the other reporters there did not take Jim Acosta's question? They had their own questions that they wanted
of
to
course,
ask the president-elect. And doesn't any president, or in this case president-elect, don't they get to pick on who they want to ask and get a question
absolutely,
from?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Now, look. There are thousands of people who want to report on the White House. Thousands of people want to report on the president. There is one president. It's a tremendous imbalance. It's a tremendously tilted field. Basically, the White House, over time, has been able to choose who they want to interview the president. That's because of this imbalance. It's just a supply and demand dynamic. And so, yes, when the president goes to another reporter, the president will likely get a different question simply because different reporters are working on different stories and different angles, and they need, first of all, to get a presidential comment for their story. So the sort of thing that I was talking about is not very common, and I don't think it's a journalistic felony not to do it. I just think it's a good thing sometimes to send a signal to the president that, you know, stiffing a legitimate reporter from a legitimate outlet with a legitimate question is not a good policy. As I said, I'm not much of a person on collective action. I wouldn't write a column about this, but I think it's a good thing to do now and again.
Let me see what Steve from Newtown has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I wanted to say that if you're going to dish it out, you got to be able to take it. It's the height of hypocrisy for us to watch a spectacle like yesterday where even before Donald spoke, he had a couple of people making speeches about unsubstantiated stories. I'm not interested in any unsubstantiated story, including anyone about Donald Trump. But, you know, I had a career in the military, and he started talking about my commander-in-chief and this unsubstantiated that he was born in the United States. It's unsubstantiated that thousands of people cheered when the Twin Towers came down. It was unsubstantiated that Hillary Clinton had anything to do with a stand-down order or a cry for help in Benghazi. It's unsubstantiated that Donald Trump won the popular vote. It's unsubstantiated that the CIA lied to us about Putin having espionage against the United States. But those are all things that Donald Trump has looked us all in the eye and lied to us straight to our face about every one of those issues. And now he's all upset about an unsubstantiated story and can't even take questions from a reporter.
Well, Steve, you laid it out there. Let me give Eric Wemple a chance to respond to that. I mean, this is a president that comes with some baggage.
Yeah, he certainly does. Steve, you make a very powerful case. You know, the interesting thing about yesterday's news conference was that the president-elect called CNN fake news. And Steve has a better list than I do, but I pointed out in a column that, you know, this is the guy who's talked about the cheering on 9/11 by Muslims, not true. Talked about the birther thing with Obama, not true. And I do think that these were deliberate lies, deliberate things that Donald Trump did to promote falsehoods. That is the very definition of fake news, as it's come to be known among some people in the media. So there was a tremendous amount of hypocrisy. I don't think there's any question about it. These press conferences, obviously there were many more before, and then he went many months without doing one. They are they're just like a world wrestling. It's like entertainment. It's really scary to me to watch and to see this. To see this lack of civility erupt between a CNN reporter who just wants to ask a question and Donald Trump, who feels not only, you know, impelled to diss the question, but also to blacken and slander the news outlet. It's just so awful.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Eric, are you comfortable with the word lie?
I am. I mean, that's a great question, by the way. I must credit you and very succinctly put. But this obviously has been a topic of great debate throughout the past year and a half for obvious reasons, because you see so many things from Donald Trump that are very clearly false. And, you know, the fact checkers say false, false, false. But false doesn't necessarily mean lie. Lie is something that is delivered with intent to deceive. It requires proving the state of mind. Now, most of the things that Donald Trump probably has said are probably not lies. They're just falsehood. Let me repeat that. Most of the false things that Donald Trump has said probably aren't lies. They're just plain falsehoods. He might be mistaken or whatever. He's just trying to make a point and going overboard on Twitter or whatever. But I think that it's fair once we have made sure and once we've documented that Donald Trump has been told the truth. In other words, that he's been corrected. This has happened in debates. This happens in interviews where, you know, either Jake Tapper or someone else from the news outlet or someone else says, Mr. Trump, that's not true. You know the facts are this, that, and the other thing. And then he comes the next interview or the next time he has a speech and he says it again. So you have to think at that point that he is either aware that it's not true or that he is proceeding with a reckless disregard of the truth. Both of those instances, I feel, basically warrant or justify calling him, saying that he is making a lie or professing a lie. That's my position on this, and I do think that it's important to use that term, and I do think also that the mainstream media over these past decades, when it's been so obsessed with propriety and making sure that both sides get a fair shake, and let's not get too far, let's not get too far out there, don't stick our necks out, have been too reluctant to use that term, even when it's pretty clear that that's what's going on. But that is a fabulous question and one that we could spend an hour on.
We certainly could. And I appreciate that. Let me get Suma from Princeton to join our conversation. And Suma, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I want the press to understand the way Donald Trump operates, his modus operandi. Well, I have observed everything from the primary to the his competition with Hillary. He always looks for the strength of their opponent and try to attack that strength and make it look weak in the eyes of the public. Similarly, if the press wants Donald Trump to respond to them, they have to look at what Donald Trump loves so much and thinks that is his strength and attack that strength. He loves the media. He likes to play around the media. He likes to play suspense. He likes to surprise people. Capitalize on that. Find a way to create a niche on that area and weaken him. In that area, he will respond to the press.
Well,
that's
Suma,
where he operates.
Okay, I appreciate the call. And Eric Wemple, is that the job of the press to find Donald Trump's weaknesses and then move in on it? I mean, he clearly likes to fight with the press, and he made that a cornerstone of his campaign. It obviously had great appeal to his fans, to his voters, to his followers.
Right. Well, pursuant to what this fellow just suggested, that Ted Cruz during the primary came out just before not long before I believe he exited the race, made this point that what Donald Trump does is he uses his own weaknesses and projects them onto other people. In other words, he called lying Ted Cruz when his own he was being attacked for being a liar and for being loose with the truth. He then projected that onto Ted Cruz. So I think that's corroboration of what this college is talking about. But I assume I'm right. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
That's right.
I was worried about screwing up the name.
That's
and
okay.
So what I do think, yes, this is a very great tradition in journalism to go after a candidate's weakness. I think that should apply as much to Hillary Clinton as Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi. Anyway, you, of course, need to look at their weaknesses and acknowledge their strengths, too, and feature profiles and so on and so forth. But that is what the job of investigative journalism is, to look at people's flaws and to expose them and to make sure that the public sees them. I feel that the media did a great job of that in the 2016 election with respect to both candidates. But, you know, there were so many investigative stories about Donald Trump's businesses, about his conflicts of interest, about how he managed beauty pageants, how he managed Atlantic City, how he managed what alleged ties to Russian mob figures, and so on and so forth. And it was just endless. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that a study that came out after the election said that that none of those stories really took hold, that they were just one after the other, a barrage, and they never, ever made much of an impression on the electorate, whereas the media's constant harping on the Hillary Clinton emails did have a bigger impact on her. And those stories were really heard. But the Donald Trump investigative journalism, as enterprising as it was, just didn't stick. So anyway, that's just a perspective.
Well, that's a show in and of itself as well.
Right.
Let me ask you, though. I mean, Donald Trump tweets, and I'm assuming when he moves into – or he's he's sworn in as president of the United States, he will continue to do that. How do you suggest, Eric, that reporters, that journalists cover those tweets, and they're provocative, and they get a lot of attention?
You have to cover the tweets. I mean, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't cover what they're looking to distract you from. But they are, you know, for the longest time, we complain that we don't get enough, you know, sort of like interaction with the president or politicians and so on and so forth. I just think that the tweets are newsworthy quite often, and I do think that sometimes it's transparent that he's trying to throw us off a trail, and so I think that we should note that. I think that we should note that Donald Trump tweeted this morning, and while a huge scandal is erupting over his handling of this, that, and the other thing. So I think that we need to be cognizant of what he's trying to do and have our eyes wide open about the entire political panorama. But, you know, these are essentially presidential pronouncements, we should take heed. We should pay heed.
Well, we could talk more, Eric Wimple. We have to say goodbye. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
No,
as always.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay.
And he reports on, writes about media for The Washington Post, talking about covering President-elect Donald Trump. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, with Susan Greenbaum helping us out today. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.